Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patty LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
One of the first pieces of Broadway trivia that I really grasped onto when I was younger was that in 1957 at the Tony Awards, the two musicals that were up for Best Musical were The Music Man and West Side Story. And The Music Man won. And for me as a youngster, I could not believe that that was the case. West Side Story, that has this kind of score and this kind of dancing to tell this tragic story with very real and serious issues, that would lose to something as fluffy as The Music Man. And that was the thing that I touted and marched around with for many, many years. I have since eaten a couple slices of humble pie offered to me by people that I respect through conversations that have helped me to realize that Music Man is the better show. And I think that the Tony Awards got it right. Even though I personally like West Side Story more, and maybe I feel that it was more courageous, I think in terms of construction, I think the Music Man's kind of a perfect show.
Yeah, a lot of people would agree with you on that, I think.
But what I think we're going to do here today is talk about how the Music Man is more than just fluff.
Right.
And how it's quite intelligent and remarkably well-constructed musical theater. So let's get started. Welcome, everybody, to a musical theater podcast where we discuss the cultural and emotional impact of some of our favorite musicals in theater history. My name is Jeffrey Scott Parsons. You can call me Jeff. And today I have Terry Bibb sitting across from me. Terry, you need to know that sometimes when I need an ego boost, I remind myself that I'm pals with Terry Bibb.
Oh, my gosh. That's so nice of you to say.
But it's true. You're like a queen of American musical theater sopranos.
Well, thank you.
I always hate interview shows where they interview really talented people and they say, "You're incredible. How does that feel? How does it feel to be so incredible?" It's just Cheetah Rivera's like, I think I'm good. One of my favorite times that I got to see you perform, though, was when we were both in Michigan. Shout out to our friends at Farmers Alley.
Farmers Alley!
Yeah. And they had brought you out to do your one-woman show.
Right.
Remind me the name of it.
Once Upon a Song.
And it's really stunning.
Oh, thanks.
Like an elegant, beautiful evening of music that spotlights women.
The great women of movie musicals, which was my introduction to the art form. So,
you sound glorious, and one of my favorite things that you say after, is it a Catherine Grayson song? You're like, "These women just sang so freaking high."
Yeah, that's the challenge of doing a one-woman show, especially for 90 minutes, you know, two 45-minute acts, is just finding a place to take a drink of water and to, you know, chill. I have strategically placed a piano solo or a little video clip here and there, so there's just not dead air while I'm like, just watch me drink for a minute here.
And you even get to change costumes.
I do. Well, I like my gowns.
As you should. If I could have a gown closet, I would. I think.
I definitely have a gown closet.
Do you?
Yes.
That makes me so happy. So over your career, how many times have you done The Music Man?
7 different productions.
Okay. And like, when was the first?
The first was 98. So over a 20-year span, actually, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. 98, I did a little tour of the Southwest with Barry Williams of the Brady Bunch fame as Harold Hill.
Oh, my gosh. And
that was my first time doing the role, which is I had auditioned for it a couple of times prior to that, but I had not gotten it. And so that was my first time.
How fun.
Yeah.
Did you immediately like it?
I did.
Yeah.
I mean,
had you seen it? I mean, you'd seen it.
I had seen a Grown Up on the movie, of course. Wanted to be Shirley Jones when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And,
she's wonderful in that movie.
Oh, she's magnificent. Yeah.
She really is.
She's great in everything she did. And you know, and one of the last times that I did Music Man was actually with her.
Oh, I did. She would play Widow Peru?
She did. She played my mom. It was a semi-concert version, another tour that I did in 2014, where she played my mom, and they she also did some narration. She told a few stories. She stepped in and out of the show.
How fun.
She put on an apron and became Widow Peru, and then she would take it off and be Shirley again and tell anecdotes. And we tweaked it a little bit so that when I sang Goodnight, My Someone, I sang it with her.
Lovely.
Yeah, to her and with her. We sang the little duet at the end that I use usually with Amaryllis because it was a very condensed concert version of the show with just 8 adults. There were no children.
Oh, wow.
We picked up a Winthrop in every town.
Oh,
we
that's
were
a
in,
great idea.
That would just come on and sing Wells Fargo Wagon.
Sure.
For everybody.
Wow.
And we actually opened in Iowa.
No way.
Yeah, so we got to tour the Meredith Wilson house.
Is it Mason City?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was really fun. And Patrick Cassidy, Shirley's son, was Harold in that
great
version.
Great casting.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about Meredith Wilson since you got to tour and maybe you can throw some things out that maybe you saw while you were there. I think The Music Man, which has music, lyrics, and book by one person, which is
very unusual.
Very unusual for musical theater. And granted, it's well documented that he had some help. But still, to be in charge of all of those things in musical is incredible and kind of a lightning bolt in a bottle.
Mm-hmm. And usually spells disaster, by
sure,
the way.
Yeah, sure.
Usually if you hear that the same person's doing all 3, you're like, oh.
You need somebody, you need another set of eyes.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's a great example of writing what you know.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's born in Iowa.
Right.
And his mentor, Frank Lesser, was always telling him how much he enjoyed hearing him talk about the Iowa way of life,
mm-hmm.
the people that he grew up with. So he obviously has a kind of natural propensity to tell stories about where he comes
from.
Boom, right there. He becomes a very accomplished piccolo player and flute player and plays in the John Philip Sousa band.
That's right.
As well as the New York Philharmonic. So, wow, right there, exposure to John Philip Sousa, which a lot of the score is, you know, basically sounds like Stars and Stripes Forever. After that, he moves to Hollywood and starts working in the film industry. He becomes a composer for film, gets an Academy Award nomination for The Great Dictator, which was a Charlie Chaplin film. The William Wyler Little Foxes, he also does as well, both of which receive Academy Award nominations. From there, he goes into radio, which is hilarious because I feel like most Broadway composers start in Broadway and then realize, oh, I can make much more money in Hollywood. And it was kind of the opposite for Meredith Wilson. He starts in Hollywood, then goes to radio. He hosts several shows, and then eventually finds himself working on a radio show called The Big Show, which was hosted by Tallulah Bankhead, who's, you know, such a character. And he decides that for the commercials for this show, instead of just breaking for a commercial and having somebody read copy, that he was going to have a chorus speak these commercials in rhythm, almost like a rap.
Oh, my gosh.
Right? So, which is also laying the groundwork for a lot of the musical conceits that he came up with for The Music Man. So between all of those things, where he comes from, the music that he's exposed to, and the discoveries that he makes while working in radio, really all come together to kind of inform how one person could write this entire musical. It's also said, however, that Franklin Lacey, who I don't know, but apparently helped him quite a bit with the story. He only took story credit, but he helped with the show. And then, I didn't know this, but when I was recording an episode with Michael Betts last week about Hello, Dolly, and we were talking about ghost composers that come in and write different songs for shows without credit in the score. And I asked what his favorite one is of those rumored songs, and he said it's My White Knight, that it was written by Frank Lesser with help from Meredith Willson.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
And I was like, really? Like, I had never heard that. I thought it was crazy. And then while revisiting the film, that's really the only difference is My White Knight is replaced with that other song. What is it?
It's so, to me, it's so forgettable.
Because
My White Knight is so...
It's so beautiful and perfect. Yeah. So it's like, okay, why would Meredith Willson replace My White Knight with something if it wasn't for the fact that maybe he just didn't feel comfortable with Frank Lesser's song being in the score? It still has that, the bridge... All I want is
All I want is a plain man, an honest man.
So maybe that was his part, and then the the mic, and then the Frank Lesser part was the refrain. I don't know.
Oh yeah,
but
I'd say that's my favorite part is that little interview in the middle
where she sits, Meredith,
and says what she wants, and I would like him to be more interested in me than he is in himself, and more interested in us than in me. I think that's such a telling line, and one of the most beautiful parts of that song.
Fast forwarding, Meredith Willson sets up camp in Brentwood, California, just down the freeway from us. And he went to church at this United Congregation in Christ or something like that. And he donated money to have a stained glass window installed right above the pew where he sat, and it's musical instruments. So, like, he's the music man. And it's still there. And so at some point, I'm going to, make a trip to Mecca over the next couple weeks.
Sit in the pew.
Yeah, and go see the Meredith Willson stained glass window.
Oh, he must have been there a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To want that there.
The entire rest of his life, I guess. Because after Music Man, he writes Unsinkable Molly Brown, which is a hit. I mean, it's not a sensation in the way that Music Man has become.
Right.
But it's a hit on both stage and in film.
Mm-hmm.
Do you like that show? Have you seen it?
I have.
Yeah.
I love the movie as well, and I have seen a couple of productions of the show.
I know that they're trying to revive it with Beth Malone.
Oh, what a great idea.
Yeah, and kind of restructuring the book a little bit. Because I think one of the big problems, at least that they faced on stage originally, was that the climax of the whole story is the Titanic.
Right.
And it's only one little scene with, they're on the lifeboats toward the end of the second act, and she's don't give up, and then blackout. So if you can make something more of that, I don't know, I have big hopes. Then he also does a musical version of Miracle on 34th Street, which is kind of a flop, doesn't do anything. And that's about it, that's all he does in musical theater.
I thought there was one more
that
I'm forgetting.
I could be forgetting, too.
Because at the home that we toured in Mason City, there was a piano with some music on it that they put there as props, not actually his music or his writing, but something that they went to the music store and bought and put there, to demonstrate. And I thought, and I have a memory of vocal selections from a musical and me thinking, I didn't know he wrote that. But of course, I can't think of what it was.
He also did It's Beginning to Look a Lot Like Christmas.
You probably made some money from that.
I
don't know what
Christmas
royalties
classic
were like back then.
But I'm sure.
Yeah.
So that's Meredith Willson. It takes him 8 years to write the show, 40 drafts, so many different songs. That's when all of, I think, the help from his mentors and friends kind of came in to help him figure out what it was going to be. When it's all ready to be produced, now they're trying to find the cast. And they've got this guy named Morton DaCosta, who's going to be the director. And I just learned his name in preparation for this episode. I didn't know who directed The Music Man, but it's this guy named Mort. And he also directed the film version mm-hmm. which I thought was kind of crazy. Usually that doesn't happen where the Broadway director is,
right.
you know, transfers to Hollywood. They get Anna White as choreographer, mm-hmm. and they are then looking for a Harold Hill and a Marion the Librarian. Marion, from the get-go, I think is Barbara Cook, because Maureen DaCosta had directed Plain and Fancy, which she was in.
Right.
And then she, the season before, she had made the huge splash as Cunegonda in
right.
Candide. Have you ever had to sing Glitter and Pique?
No, I actually worked on it a lot when I was back in the days when I was touring with Phantom and they were getting ready for the revival that Hal
oh.
was directing. And since I was working with Hal presently, I was a handful of actresses that, you know, were at the top of the list for, that he wanted to see.
That's awesome.
But I, you know, touring is hard on you and singing
yeah.
Christine, you know. So I found it just a skosh too high.
Really?
If it had been a half step down, you know, if I was completely fresh and rested, but I could sing it. I could sing those high E's mm-hmm. at the end. But, or they were E flats, because we had an E in Phantom, but it was just one.
Oh, wait, when but, is it? Is it in Think of Me?
It's in the cadenzas, the...
Oh, oh.
And she sings 3 C's in a row, and then she sings an E. But we only had to do that once.
Nice.
And this was a lot of E flats at the end of a very long, difficult aria, just over and over and over. And I just found it just a little bit too challenging.
That's
I my
exhausting.
Hats off to anybody, and I think it's a very specific voice type that is easy for.
Right. And Barbara Cook was she was a light soprano.
Well, but she was also really versatile.
Yeah.
And the way she continued her career into her later years and just morphed
Sweet.
Into this cabaret chanteuse, mm-hmm. you know, she sings with such feeling and such emotion. I mean, she was always my idol. That's who I wanted to sing like.
Really?
Yeah.
What Music Man, She Loves Me, what were your favorites?
She Loves Me especially.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me, that is the quintessential soprano role. I mean, great spirit, incredible songs, and unbelievable book scenes. I've done that show 4 times, I think.
Including and, New York.
Yeah, that's how I made my Broadway debut.
Oh.
I was the standby. And so I got to do it, I think, 11 times totally.
Oh, that's awesome.
And I quit Phantom. We were at the Kennedy Center at the time. I quit that to do She Loves Me on Broadway.
I have recorded 3 episodes at this point, and all of them have included She Loves Me.
It's just the perfect, to me, it's the perfect little jewel
it
of
is,
a musical.
It is a
I
little
love
jewel.
It so much.
It really is. You're totally right. I might have to have you back, and we'll do a She Loves Me.
I love it so much. Yeah.
Okay, so Barbara Cook signs on for Marion. Now they're looking for Harold Hill, which is kind of the crux that the entire show
right.
lands on. And she says in her biography that when she went to listen to the score for the first time, that she was there to hear the score and Andy Griffith was there.
Interesting.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So he was a possibility. They had also offered it to Gene Kelly, who had turned it down. A lot of people turned it down. Ray Bolger really wanted to do it, but who is a, you know, fantastic mm-hmm. song and dance man, but maybe not much sex appeal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that they passed on him and ultimately gave it to Robert Preston, who at this point was not known as being a musical kind of guy. He was a Hollywood actor, mostly in Westerns. So he's kind of making his musical theater debut as Harold Hill and just owns it. And when you... there's such an elegance about him.
Yeah.
And such a musical energy, it's hard to believe that he...
Because he seems like he's totally in his element.
Yeah, completely. That's exactly how I should have said it. When you've done the show, what would you say the biggest requirements are of the guy playing Harold Hill? Like, what makes a great Harold Hill?
Confidence and charm and swagger, but there also has to be a... an underlying sincerity. There has to be an underlying vulnerability, if you will, because he can't be too slick, because then he comes off as smarmy, and he does some rather unappealing things.
Yeah.
And so you have to have that vulnerability and softness to undercut that, so that you see him through the eyes that Marion and Winthrop and ultimately the entire town sees him in.
I think that is the dreamer quality, right?
Yes.
Because more than anything, he's this dreamer who...
He believes it in... Yeah.
He's selling them
a tall tale, but there's always a band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go through the plot a little bit, just kind of go through the show and talk about our favorite moments or maybe even the moments you don't care for. But the show begins with this, like I said, this John Philip Sousa overture, which then gives way to an opening number that has no underscoring whatsoever. And that feels revolutionary to me.
Yeah.
That there is an opening number of a musical that has no music.
Right. And it's quite lengthy.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And it establishes a lot of what's happening without being obviously exposition, related. I think it's a brilliant piece.
It's
one of the more challenging numbers of the piece, and one that is rehearsed more than many numbers in the show.
You get your call for the next day. And
you're like, they're doing the train scene again. The salesman are called. Yeah. Because it's just challenging. It's exposed.
Yeah.
Everyone has equal weight. Cannot lose your focus.
Yeah.
You have to really keep your ears open and not, because one just takes one falter for the whole train to become derailed, so to speak. You lose that rhythm and the whole.
Now, in addition to being an amazing actress and soprano, you're an amazing proofreader. A little known fact. You're really good at grammar, and I'm wondering, is there a definition of a, is it onomatopoeia?
Where it sounds like a word that sounds like what it is.
Yeah.
Yes.
In a way, this number in and of itself
is the train.
Is a train.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Even the words that he's used.
Even though, what do you talk? That's the clickety-click.
Yes,
clickety-click.
Sir.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
that's
sir.
Uh-huh.
And so all of these salesmen are on the train, right? And they're talking about being salesmen. And since they're on a train, it's almost as though the chug, the momentum of the train has taken over the pattern and patter of speech that they're using to communicate with each other. And during the number, we find out about this guy, Harold Hill, who has made it kind of impossible for any other salesman in the Midwest, because he goes in and swindles people out of their money and then runs out of town. And so then the next guy who comes in basically gets tarred and feathered and shut away. So all of these stories and rumors are being passed around among this train full of salesmen. And then when it comes to stop in River City, Iowa, a guy stands up and says, "You know what, I think I'm going to give this place a try." And it turns out Harold Hill's been sitting there the whole time. Now, they're doing a revival, right, with Hugh Jackman in New York. Uh-huh. And I'm just wondering how they're going to do this, because there's no way that an audience in 2019 that's seen Music Man as much as it is going to be doing anything but trying to spot where Hugh Jackman is on that train.
Right.
Because, you know what I mean? I wonder if they're just going to do it traditionally, if they're going to find out.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, typically what they do is put his back, he's mostly in profile or even three-quarter away from the audience with a hat on, or sometimes even a newspaper. But that becomes obvious if he's the only one not speaking.
Exactly.
Unless they add more salesmen that don't speak.
They just have, like, Winthrop with a suit.
Yeah, it's a very short salesman sitting there. Yeah.
So anyway, I'm really curious to see what they do. That gives way to kind of the opening number of Iowa, which is called Iowa Stubborn. Now, we talked about spending some time in Michigan. That was my first time in the Midwest.
Mm.
But it sounds like you've been on tour a lot. So,
yeah.
And where are you from originally?
I was born in Texas and grew up in Oklahoma.
No way, where in Texas?
A Big Spring, a little town. What? Do you know Big Spring?
You're kidding.
You don't know Big
That's
Spring.
Where I serve my mission.
Really?
Yes.
That's insane.
That's crazy. I would go to Big Spring for my district meetings. because and I was in an even smaller town called Big Lake, which is like 60 miles north.
Which is hilarious because a lake is bigger than a spring.
Go figure. What's funny about Big Lake is there is neither a lake nor is it big.
Right.
And I was there in that little town, and we would we had a car, but you were only allowed to drive so many miles in the car if you didn't have a bike. So we would save all of our miles because we would have to drive to Big Spring each week. And then while we were up there, we would go to Walmart because there weren't any. The grocery stores in Big Lake were just so expensive because of the inflation. You know, you're like, right. You're just this tiny town. And so the little local store has Golden Grahams for $6 a box. Like, it's insane. So I know Big Spring really well.
That and then, so crazy.
That's crazy.
It is crazy. Well, we were there because it was an Air Force town. There was an Air Force base, Webb Air Force base. My father was Air Force. And so career Air Force. So we lived there till I was four. And then we moved to Tacoma, Washington. And that's where my little sister was born. And then in the middle of the fourth grade, after my dad got back from Vietnam, we moved to a little town, Altus, Oklahoma, which is another Air Force town.
Wow.
Which, there's still a base there. And that's where I went to grade school, junior high school.
And so do you consider yourself like an Oklahoma gal?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's where I spent my formative years, for sure. And then I went to OCU, Oklahoma City University.
Oh.
So, yeah, I think of myself more of as, but also I've lived so many places.
Sure.
And couldn't wait to get out, really. You know, just
sure.
As a child, wanted to get out, see the world, have adventures. And so I don't really define myself in that way.
I just learned more about you. I didn't know. So then you know the Midwest much better than I do. What, in terms of what Meredith Wilson explores in Iowa Stubborn, do you kind of get what he's going for?
Sure, except for I would say I haven't personally had a lot of Iowa experience other than that a few times on tour. I would say that most of the Midwest has a friendlier reputation than his Iowans
yeah.
do.
Yeah, totally.
There was, being an Air Force town, a lot of people would come to Altus from all over the country, and there was a family that had moved in from New Jersey. From the East Coast, and they walked into the United grocery store and four people said, "Good morning, how are you today?" And they freaked out and left. They were like, "Why are you talking to me? I don't know you." So I think it's maybe partially true with their frosty exterior, but it's also a conceit of the show to set up that these people were not easily flim-flammed, and yet they purported to themselves to not be easily flim-flammed, and yet they totally were.
My experience in the Midwest was that there's a refreshing lack of pretense.
Yeah.
Where in California, I think that people, I wouldn't say that people are fake, but I think that people can pretend to be nice to you because more than likely they're going to get into their cars and never see you again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like, I can pretend to be nice because I have my own space. In New York, on the East Coast, nobody has their own space. So they just don't have time to pretend to like you.
Yeah.
And then in the Midwest, people think, what does pretend mean? Like, they just, like, it's not even a concept in terms of culture. So if they're polite, then they're going to be polite and friendly. And if they're not interested in you,
straightforward.
This is just straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, Iowa. they sing Iowa Stubborn, which is, like you said, establishing this group of people who seem like a challenge for Harold Hill. And he is ultimately trying to sell them a boys' band. Get them to buy instruments, get them to buy uniforms. He's going to teach them how to play, you know, and be in the band. But the truth is that he has no training. He doesn't know anything about music and has no intention of teaching them anything about music. And that he'll jump town before they figure that out.
Right.
So what he needs is an inn to get these people riled up. And the inn, it turns out to be a new pool table that's being, well, I guess, installed in the main...
Yes, in the billiard parlor.
In the billiard parlor downtown. And so he starts spreading this rumor that this pool table is going to turn all of the boys in the town to destructive behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to get them involved in some sort of wholesome activity.
Like a band.
just an idea. And he does this all through another type of patter song. Is it just called Trouble?
Yeah. I think it's just called Trouble.
Which is a tour de force and really fun to watch. I wanted to talk a little bit about Ona White at this point, because I think that she's a choreographer that most people don't know about. And yet, if you go to see, say, The Music Man, there you will see touches of her all over the place because she came up with such an iconic vocabulary in terms of dance. And I think the first example is right here in Trouble with the pulses, trouble, 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 or, oh, we got trouble with, like, the shimmery hands. Jazz hands. Those are all things that she established right at the beginning, and every community theater you're going to go to is probably going to, you know, lift those things very lovingly from that original stuff. But what's really interesting is that she was nominated for Tony Awards her entire life. She never won one. And every time she had a big hit, like The Music Man, there was always another hit that same season that had, that maybe wasn't as big, but had a more celebrated choreographic element. So in this case, Music Man, West Side Story, Jerome Robbins, is the one who steps forward as like the big choreographer of the season. She does MAME, which also is a huge, huge hit, but that same season is Sweet Charity. So Bob Fosse takes like the gold for that. And then later on, she just kind of keeps getting assigned, I don't know, assigned or chooses these projects that just aren't very good. Like, I Love My Wife and kind of these flop shows, which she does quality work for, but aren't hits and kind of do nothing for her.
I didn't realize that she never got a Tony.
Yeah, isn't that strange? But The Music Man, is her work in that is every bit as iconic as any other Hello Dolly, West Side Story. Try seeing a Shapoopy that doesn't have the little, you know, legs back and forth cakewalk sort
or
of thing.
Or the trombones.
In 76
trombones.
Absolutely. I love Music Man as well because there are so many great characters. So you've got Harold Hill, you've got all the salesmen, you've got these, and then these really interesting people in Iowa, all of whom have backstories and names, and you've got the mayor who is constantly trying to give his Gettysburg address and thinks that he, like many small town governments, thinks he's much more important than he actually is. He always has these lines that are this close to being the right saying, but they're not.
Right. He's full of malapropisms, always. Yeah, that's what
was that? Grammat?
Malapropism.
Wow. Write it down, podcast listeners.
It might not be the correct use of that word.
I don't know.
Malaprops.
Cool. Yeah?
Yeah. Another funny thing, since I've done 7 productions of it, it is often the case that the man that they have cast as Mayor Shin has trouble with those lines.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, maybe
just trying to remember why they're wrong?
Maybe it's, why? What exactly is wrong with them? And so sometimes it's a joke within a joke as far as the cast goes, because the line is written incorrectly and the actor can't seem to get it right.
Can't get the incorrect right. That's kind of brilliant.
Yeah, it's kind of brilliant. We had Alan Young as our Mayor Shin, Mr. Ed fame.
Oh.
When I did it in 98 with...
Wait, was he Wilbur?
Yes. Well, wasn't the horse Wilbur?
Oh, I don't know.
No, the horse
was Mr. Ed.
That's right. Yes, he was Wilbur.
Oh my gosh, how cool.
And he was a marvelous Mayor Shin, but he also struggled with those lines, and he would just kind of stutter along until he finally got it out, and it was a great quality for Mayor Shin, and he was so endearing as a person.
That's fantastic. Yeah. His wife is
Eulalie, which is a great character.
I mean...
Yeah, I hope to play her someday.
You just graduate. You're like, skip Widow Peru. I want to go straight to Eulalie McKechnie. I love that she's 3 names as someone who's Jeffrey Scott Parsons. Like, she is a woman who must be called by all 3 names at any moment.
And she's reticent. She has great lines as
she
well.
She has fantastic lines.
The Grecian urns.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. The first time where we see her, she's participating in this patriotic display, and she's kind of a conundrum in that she seems to be both dedicated to the arts and then also
very judgy about
very
them.
Very judgy about them, right? Because she doesn't like Marion and her books,
right?
And yet she's constantly looking out for the welfare of the community in terms of being exposed to the arts. Right. So it's kind of, it's an interesting character.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got all of her minions, mm-hmm. all of whom have names.
The Piccolo Ladies.
The Piccolo Ladies. Mm-hmm. Can you explain to me Marcellus? Like, how do he and Harold Hill know each other?
They were in business. They were, they traveled together for a period.
Okay.
As he was his sidekick. Marcellus was his...
And were they doing the boys band at
yes,
that point?
Yes, they were. They did many things, including the band.
Okay.
And then they had too many close shaves for Marcellus's taste, so he somehow ended up in this town.
Kind of settling down and leaving that life.
Yes, leaving that life behind until Greg, as he knows Harold Hill,
right.
Greg shows up and he says, he's the one who tells him about the pool table.
And does he know that Marcellus lives there, or is it just
no,
purely
it's
coincidence?
Purely coincidence.
Okay.
Yeah, he has no idea.
Wow, that's impressive. So then he's helping Harold Hill lay the groundwork and puts him in contact with Marion.
Yeah, tells him that he won't get anywhere in this town because there's a stuck-up librarian that's also the music teacher, and she'll expose you.
Immediately.
Yeah.
But Harold Hill's like, actually, I've made it an art of wooing music teachers. Yeah. I got this, no problem.
Uh-huh.
He starts to try to do that, and Marion immediately shuts him down.
Yeah.
I remember going to see a production of The Music Man, and you were in the audience, and we had a little conversation afterward. And I remember just seeing how passionate you were about the character mm-hmm. in connecting to her depth, and that it's not just a typical ingenue.
Mm-mm.
How do you see her?
Well, there are a lot of theories as to how she ended up in this town.
Oh, interesting.
And how she ended up befriending old Miser Madison and inheriting this job at the library and the books. I've worked with some directors who think Winthrop is actually her child.
Come on, people.
I know.
Interesting,
yeah.
though.
And it does become problematic as one ages in this role. To have a little brother who's 10.
Who's also, that's fair.
I'm like, well, let's see, I'm 40 and I have a 10-year-old boy, Widow Peru. She was fertile for a lot of years.
It was a surprise.
Yeah,
package.
So there is that element. But some people just, you know, they read a little more into the backstory as to why this happened. So I personally just think that she tells her mother about being backed into the library desk by Luther Grinder or somebody's removable backseat. I think she's had bad experiences with dating mm-hmm. men, and especially being an intelligent, articulate, well-read single woman of a certain age for that time period. She wasn't just going to give in to just anybody. And she has standards, and as her mother said, way too high of standards. She was never going to meet. Who do you expect this knight in shining armor to come mm-hmm. riding up? And that's why she sings My White Knight to her mom to explain what she's looking for.
Do you think that there is a degree of men hoping that she is desperate enough to just kind of sleep with whoever?
I would imagine so, but also that's why she's judged so harshly by the women in the town, is that she's not giving in. She's not living the life that they're all expecting her.
Mm-hmm.
And I get the impression that she's more educated, that I don't know if she actually went to like a... I didn't do enough research to know if back in 10, 11, 12, if there were women's colleges. I'm mm-hmm. assuming there were, that she could go for a year or two maybe, and maybe had a bad experience with a love interest, or maybe it was just that her father was ill, and that's why she came home to take care of her mother and her younger brother.
I think so, maybe subconsciously that's what I always felt.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
but she's stuck in, for whatever reason, she's stuck in this provincial place that she doesn't feel she belongs. And she's a dreamer, too.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. So they are kindred spirits, though they might not recognize it at the beginning.
Right.
When she comes home, there's a little girl playing the piano that she's... Because she's a librarian, but she's also a piano teacher.
Yes.
So she's Amaryllis is the little girl, and she's there taking her piano lesson. And this is another great example of Meredith Willson using mm-hmm. something narrative-driven to create a song. So you've got her exercises, her piano exercises, mm-hmm. and her little pieces that she's rehearsing that become the way that Widow Peru and Marion are
have this argument. Yeah.
And it's so smart.
It is very smart.
It's a great, great scene.
Yeah.
In it, Marion's kind of revealing all of this information about neither does anybody else in this town.
Yeah.
And Widow Peru's shooting down everything that she, you know, every gun in her artillery. At which point, then Winthrop, the little boy, comes in, and Amaryllis tries to talk to him. It's obvious that Amaryllis has a crush on him, and he won't say anything. Widow Peru makes him say something to
say her name,
which then reveals that he has this horrible lisp. And Amaryllis laughs, and then Winthrop gets angry, and then Amaryllis has the audacity to say, why does he get so angry? And I really want Marion to be like, because you're being a dick.
Yes, you're really. Yeah.
But they don't. Instead, they try and, like, shed some sort of. Because I think the whole idea is that Amaryllis has a crush on him. And when you're in elementary school, that idea of making fun of somebody but also having a crush on them is.
Yeah, just like little boys throwing footballs in your face when they like you.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. It makes no sense, but that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Then they sing Goodnight, My Someone, which is also attached to one of her crosshand piece that that Amaryllis plays. And here is one of the things that I kind of want to talk about, because even though Marion is a very intelligent, you know, not at all a stereotypical character, every song that she sings is about a man, essentially.
Right.
And when we were recording the episode about Fiddler on the Roof, I kind of shared this experience that the first time I was exposed to the show, Golda scared me. Like, her character just seemed a little off-putting to me. And it has sent me down this road of wondering, is musical theater full of female stereotypes, or women who play them like stereotypes, or audience members like me who just have this really narrow idea of what women are and should act like. It's probably a combination of all three.
I think it most definitely is a combination of all three.
But especially for, I mean, sopranos and soprano roles, who are usually ingenues. Like, what's your experience with that?
That's a very loaded question, because it's something that I've struggled with, especially as I've gotten older. I'm in my 50s now, and the work has really dried up. That's why I created my own show. That's why I do mostly concerts now and more plays, because there are more roles in plays for women as they get older. But for musical theater women, sopranos are inevitably ingenues or young leading women. And then you can stretch it a little bit, and you have Anna Leon Owens in The King and I, who can be a little older. Marion is often played a little older, meaning really into her late 30s as an actress. Now, I played Marion into my way longer than I should have. But there aren't roles, with the exception of the Mother Abbess in The Sound of Music, and she's usually cast, like, really character-y. She's often cast very heavy set or very motherly and matronly. She's not cast physically the way I look. I still look the way I looked when I was playing Christine in Phantom. I'm just older.
Right.
But I'm still the same size. I still sing the same way. So there's the Mother Abbess. There's Nettie Fowler in Carousel, June is Busting Out Oliver. But again, she's usually cast
more
character-y. Then there's Margaret in Light of the Piazza.
And
when that came along, it was like, oh, hallelujah. You know, I got to play that. I played that at Farmer's Alley.
I didn't even think
Kalamazoo.
About that.
And that's a brilliant acting role and a beautiful, legit soprano singing role. And she's a woman in her 50s.
Wow.
But that is really it.
Wow.
Every other role is, you look at the canon, you look at Mama Rose, you look at Golda. You know, they're all belty character women.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what the sopranos are supposed to do. I don't know if we just are expected to have babies and retire.
And go away.
Or evolve the way Barbara Cook did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but you don't see.
But even then, Barbara didn't do shows in her later years.
No.
She never did a Brilliant Book musical after The Grasshopper.
Right. And she didn't stay looking the way she always looked when she was young.
True.
So, yeah, it's a very, I don't understand it. I've never understood it. And there used to be Kate in Kiss Me, Kate. That was a role. Catherine Grace had did the film. That was a role that you could age into. But when they did the recent revivals with God Rest Your Soul, Maren Maisie, mm-hmm. and other ones since then, they've lowered all the keys, least a third.
Wow, I don't think I realized that.
Yeah,
so they lowered them. So it's a little more
mezzo-y. Yeah, and I went in to audition for it. In the last 10 years, and the director said, oh, yeah, this is the lower key. And I was like, oh, I didn't know that. And he said, yeah, it's just so much warmer and less shrill, you know. And I was like, really? I think my voice is very warm. I don't know why you say that. Yeah, so they took that one away.
Wow, that's interesting.
No, I got to do it in August with the Marina Del Rey Symphony, and they did, because it was a 56-piece symphony, the only keys available were the original keys, so I got to sing it.
Oh, that's amazing.
But
with Marian, I wonder, because Sun Foster's playing it in New York, I wonder what the keys are going to be for that. Even that, remember the TV version?
Oh, yeah, they lowered it for Kristen, and Kristen had the high notes, but they lowered it.
They hired a soprano and then changed the keys.
I don't understand it.
At some point, we decided that in order to be a smart woman, you couldn't be a soprano, is what it looks like to me.
Yeah, and it doesn't really make sense to me.
No.
Why are they equated?
Yeah.
You know, why can't you sing high and beautifully and be a woman of substance?
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense.
Do you and, like, Rebecca Luker just get together and have these conversations? In my mind, like, that's what I do.
I wish. I mean, I could see us having it. I don't get to see her very often. And it was funny because she was always a step ahead of me in New York. So one of the reasons I left New York, partly because my husband Andy wanted to come out here and do more film and TV. And at the time, there wasn't much film and TV in New York. Now there is a ton. But back then, there wasn't, 22 years ago when we moved out here. But one of the reasons I did was it seemed to me that my option was to stay in Phantom. All roads seemed to lead back to Phantom, and I was really ready to do something else, or to understudy Rebecca and whatever she was doing next.
Be Rebecca's alternate,
yeah.
And Phantom.
Because she was always just one step ahead of me. You know, she'd been there longer. It's just the way things played out.
That's funny.
I love her. I think she's terrific.
Oh, she is wonderful.
Beautiful soprano and lovely person.
What, because you spent so much time with Phantom, do you feel like Christine is a smart person?
That's a very valid question, because I think that when we first started, because, you know, I started with the national tour, so there was Broadway and there was L.A.,
mm-hmm.
and then we were the next company. I think when we first started, there was a school of thought that she was supposed to be played really dumb.
Mm. She's just like this wide-eyed...
Yeah, and I didn't get that at all. I played her as a woman struggling with the loss of her father, who had this talent and didn't really know what to do with it.
Wow, I didn't even think about that.
And this voice appears in her dressing room, and he's coaching her. He's teaching her how to sing, and she's really ambitious. She takes over for Carlotta and mm-hmm. sings this aria at the top of the show. So, and she's confused by all of it. She's mm-hmm. confused because he's mixed up in her mind as this father figure and mentor and teacher, and yet there's obviously a component where of mystery and allure. I didn't choose to go to this sexual place as some people, like in the sequel, I guess they've slept together.
Yeah.
And that's just totally gross to me, because if they did, it was in the boat, and she wakes up in the boat and has very hazy memories, and that means what happened there.
Sure.
Like, Christine,
no, so
me too. You know, I don't even want to think about that, because to me, he was a father figure and a mentor, and that's why she went with Raoul at the mm-hmm. end. Not because he was deformed.
Yeah,
you know,
well, and that is it's a deeper choice for Christine as well, because then it doesn't have really anything to do with the malformity of his face.
Right.
Even though
it was his soul. She says it to him.
Even though from his perspective it is.
Right.
You know, that
right.
of course you couldn't love me because da da da. And
right.
she's like, no, it's because I think of you as my dad.
And because you've done all these horrible things. You
well,
killed
that's,
Bouquet.
Well,
and
that's
you,
fair
and
enough.
And you've got Raoul in a noose. You're going to kill him in a minute and all that stuff. You know, he's done some despicable things.
That's fascinating.
Because he was picked on, you know.
Right. Not without blame, these
yeah,
men.
Yeah.
In
so I chose not to play her dumb. I mean, she's certainly, the way the show is written, she's not as complex a character. And a lot of that is just, you know, choices that you make.
I would have loved to have seen you do it, because I think that it on the page, to me, she seems a little victim-y.
I got a note from Hal. I went through, I've saved them all. He was a prolific writer.
Really?
And I would send him birthday cards. And he would write me back. And after he passed this summer, I pulled out all my notes from him and just laid them out on the desk and reread them. And some of them I had forgotten. And in one of them, he said something about how much he appreciated my intelligence in the role.
Oh, what a great compliment.
I really took that to heart.
All right, sorry, back to Music Man. We get to see kind of the first big push for Harold Hill to try and court Marion in the library scene.
That's after 70. So he's already started wooing the town in 1776, and she's having no part of it.
Yes.
And so then he tries with her again, and she says, I have a shelf full of books in there which will expose you. So, I'm not as easily hoodwinked and mesmerized as some people in this town.
Nice.
So then he follows her in the library. And that's another example of Anna White's brilliant choreography, the use of the books and the rolling library cart and the students getting rambunctious with their dance while being completely quiet because they're in the library.
I'm also kind of obsessed with the fact that the kids go to the library to hang out. I don't think we give enough time to the fact that they're all in the library really loving life.
Yeah.
I want that. I want that. I want to live in that town.
Yeah.
But you're exactly right, especially with the kind of hook, the dun da 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 da, and then you've got this rhythmic stamping of the books that fits so perfectly in it. It's another one of those songs that sounds like exactly what it should be in this.
And it makes you wonder if they named her Marion just so he could rhyme with librarian for this song.
Fair enough.
You know, wonder if that, how early in the process that happened. Yeah. Or if it was just a coincidence.
It's a fantastic coincidence if that's the case. In terms of your arc with the character, by the end of Marion the Librarian, where does she stand with him?
I think she's sexually attracted to him.
Mm.
He gets in her face a lot in that number, and she gets carried away in some of the dancing, and she hasn't danced with a man in a long time, and he's obviously very attractive. I think she found him attractive the first time she saw him, but that number in the library is the first time she allows herself to give in a little bit, and that even makes her more angry. So, because she catches herself at the end, and he sticks the marshmallow in her mouth, and she goes to slap him, and she misses, and she hits Tommy Jellison instead.
That's right.
So the next time she sees him, she's just as furious, and she's furious at him, and she's furious at herself.
Okay, my first experience with The Music Man was in a community theater production when I was in high school, and the Tommy Jellison, I can't remember what happened, but they brought me in, final dress to learn the show, and I was my one memory of the whole thing was that I was so flustered I kept saying Jelly Kill instead of Jelly Cly. It's like Jelly Kill.
Well, it makes just as much sense.
Yeah, I mean, well, what are you gonna do, right? Okay, what happens after Marion the Librarian?
He shows up on her front porch, and he's wooing Mrs. Peru. And
yes.
Winthrop comes out and says a few sentences.
Because he's so excited.
Time. Yeah, he's excited about the band uniforms. He's going to get measured for a band uniform, and he asks if there's going to be a big, wide
stripe
up the side.
That's so cute.
So, and she witnesses this, and that's, she's already angry that she gave in, and now he sees it, now she sees that he's working on her family, and especially her kid brother, who's hurting and vulnerable, and that's when she really lets loose on him. That's the harshest that she is with him. And that leads right into My White Knight.
It's interesting that your director talked about this idea that Marion could be Winthrop's mom, because there is a real protectiveness in a way that, like, a woman post-divorce would be about, like, a new guy trying to get in with the kid, not knowing what the commitment or the future of the relationship's going to be. Like, how dare you get my son to fall in love with you when you may be gone the next day.
Right.
You know? There is kind of that play. Then she sings My White Knight, which is fantastic.
It's really an aria.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in Barbara Cook's book, she talks about how she would give herself like a task to help keep the show fresh when she was in New York. And one of the ones that she always liked to give herself was, how courageous are you going to be to communicate and act this song without needing to move around a lot? Which I thought is a really interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah.
Because she's a very active performer, emotionally speaking. Yeah. But then how do you communicate that without feeling like you need to move a lot? And that's the kind of song that can hold that kind of dramatic power, I think. That's not the end of Act One, though.
No. Wells Fargo.
Wells Fargo happens.
Right after that,
I have this love of Wells Fargo because then you really, especially in community theater productions, you get to see all of the different solos. And you...
I bought a box of maple syrup on my birthday.
Exactly. And you're like, that guy probably works for the post office during the day.
Yeah.
Like, this little girl wants to be Annie so bad.
Right.
Like, you just get to see
all
the
personalities. Yeah, and I've done quite a few of those kind of productions where they would bring in... three or four or five, you know, equity actors from someplace, and then the rest of the company would be locals. My friend Audrey, she says, there are a lot of neighbors in that production.
That's so sweet. I've always wanted to see a production of Music Man in Fresno because my mind, somebody goes, I hope I get my raisins from Fresno, and the whole audience just, like, bursts into applause.
That's like they do at rock concerts when they say, hey, Chicago!
Yeah, exactly. But you do it at the Music Man. That's my dream. That's my musical theater dream. So, Thister, Winthrop gets his...
cornet.
Is it his cornet from the Wells Fargo wagon, which is a...
Harold Hill personally hands it to him.
Which is a delivery system, I guess we should say. Like, the Wells Fargo wagon...
That's how they got their packages.
Is the Amazon of this day. So it's bringing all the packages. Harold Hill gives the cornet to Winthrop. He's elated, and all fear of the lisp completely goes away.
Yep.
And she can't help but be touched by that.
Right. He says three or four sentences just full of S's.
The most S's that you could possibly
have. The scrumptious, solid gold thing.
And that melts her heart. And she decides, after having found this information that will ultimately prove that he is
a fake.
A fake.
He didn't go to the Gary Conservatory conservation class of Odd Five.
You have done this a few times. And she decides to destroy the evidence,
Well, she doesn't destroy it, but she tears it out and puts it in a safe place. Oh, she doesn't give it to the mayor.
All right. Oh, we forgot the quartet.
Oh, yes, the barbershop quartet.
I love that in 2019, people still lose their minds.
Like, oh, yeah.
You could have that barbershop quartet perform at a high school. You know, you could have high school kids come to see Music Man, and they would still kill.
Yeah.
People lose their minds over that stuff. What do you think it is?
I don't know. I think it's something about the tight harmonies and the way the barbershop tradition of being in really close and then to expand into a wider chord with that straight tone and that swell and the cut. A really good barbershop sound is so electric. My mom sang with the Sweet Adelines for years, Sweet Adeline chorus. It's the female version of the barbershop. What are they called? I can't think of it. It's a nationwide.
Like an association.
Actually, it's international.
Really?
It's international, and they have competitions, and they have quartet competitions, and then they have chorus competitions. And the chorus, that's what my mom did. She was in the chorus. And the choruses are huge. They can be 150, 200 people. And they stand on risers, and the front row does choreography.
Oh.
And the back rows do handography here and there.
Cute.
And they sing these incredible barbershop arrangements. And I went... I don't remember where it was, but my mom's chorus, which they were the Rich Tones outside Dallas-Fort Worth, Richardson, Texas, is that right? The Rich Tones, and they were an award-winning chorus. And they were in the national finals, I think, and they were rehearsing. And I went into the room and listened to them rehearse for a half an hour. And I can't tell you how many times they would just hit a chord. Every hair on my body would stand straight up. And tears would just spurt from my eyes.
Like,
I wouldn't feel emotional. I wouldn't feel like, oh, I'm going to cry. I would just suddenly go, oh, tears are spurting out of my eyes. It was a physical response to these chords, to the harmonics, to the overtones, to the pure tone of these 160 voices all coming together, and the way they start in one place and all slide in opposite directions and all land at the same time, it's just electric. And that's when these four guys do it in the midst of having these goofy characters and these arguments, when they just burst into these really pure barbershop sounds, I think it's always very effective.
And such a genius way of incorporating into the story as well, mm-hmm. that they're the school board who can't get along
until he teaches
them how to sing, and he hears them all kind of arguing in their registers and identifies their timbres as being perfect for barbershop, which kind of leads you to think that maybe he does know a little bit about music.
Yeah.
And so then he says, you know, to the women of the town, like, you'll never see these four apart. And they're like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, you're crazy.
But then he's totally right. They find this harmony that they haven't been able to find as colleagues.
Yeah, and very effectively used throughout the show in different, like you were asking me earlier if I had a favorite moment in the show. One of my favorite moments in the show is singing Light a Rose, singing my counterpoint to Light a Rose. I love that. I love it so much that I put it in my solo show. And then they come back and sing that again after Charlie Cowell lays the bombshell on her about how many women he's been with. And that was another one of my favorite moments, because they would do this crossing of this beautiful Light a Rose stuff, and they would go, good evening, Miss Marion. And that was a really nice way for me to get to the emotional space I needed to be in for Harold's reentrance after I've just heard that he's got a woman, a music teacher in every town. And
oof, that's heavy.
Yeah.
How great that you have something musical to get you into, you know.
Because, for me, music is always
Well, and I think it is, even when you were saying, I wasn't even necessarily emotionally moved by this,
right.
but the just because of the way that it sounded, right. my body involuntarily responded.
That's why we have film scores.
Yeah.
Because your body responds to the spooky music and the Jaws music and the swell of beautiful vistas. You have a physical response to that.
Act two begins with Shapoopy.
Yes, and that is my least favorite moment in the show.
Is it? How come?
It feels formulaic to me. Even though I've done it seven different times, and we've done it some different ways, it's always you end up standing up and flapping your arms and doing this goofy dance.
Welcome to my life. Like, how am I going to make this one work?
Yeah, and I don't... The song itself, I find a little bit problematic in today's, you know, I just...
Oh, I don't think I've ever even listened to the...
A woman who'll kiss on the very first date is usually a hussy.
And the woman who'll kiss on the
second time out is anything but fussy.
Oof.
Yeah, and the third time around, she's a girl I'm glad I found.
She's my Shapoopy.
Yeah, so... It's
the
a
girl
little,
who's hard to get.
Yeah.
I mean, is it meant to be you? Is it meant to be Marion?
I don't think so.
Like, the girl who's hard to get is your Shapoopy?
Gosh, I never thought of it that way.
I don't know.
It's Marcellus, you know.
Yeah.
We have to talk to some Marcelluses and see what
they
think.
I'm sure they did a lot. I'm sure Buddy Hackett really, picked apart.
Get Jason Graw in here. I'm sure he has a lot of opinions.
Jason, tell me about Marcellus and why he's the most important part of The Music Man. But great choreography.
Yeah.
Why not?
You
get to see the kids dance their faces off. After that, this is when it becomes a love story. Yeah?
Yeah.
And it's all kind of leading up to this...
It's the ice cream sociable.
Oh, it was a different time. I'm actually kind of interested now, after having had this conversation of moving to River City, but only in the Music Man time period.
Right.
Because I want to have parties at the library and ice cream sociables.
Yeah.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
Gay rides probably don't exist.
No.
But that's okay.
They have to meet somewhere behind the footbridge. They couldn't meet on the footbridge.
Just under the footbridge. Like a little troll. Let's actually skip right till there was you, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Oh, actually, we should talk about Charlie Cowell.
Yeah, well, there's the Charlie Cowell moment where he exposes him for what he really is, and she still makes the decision
to stick up for him.
To stick up for him, and Another component, since you mentioned being thrust into the role of Tommy Chelis, yep. is that he's kind of important in Marion's transformation as well.
Tommy is?
Yeah, because he wasn't kind of a bad kid.
Oh,
he
that
was
is
kind
true.
Of a ne'er-do-well. And Harold giving him tasks, giving him mechanically
Something
minded,
to do.
Giving him the place for a flute player to hold his music, mm-hmm. you know, it took him off the streets.
Yeah.
Because he had heard for so long that he was a bad kid, he started to believe it. And Harold was the first one who said, "You're not a bad kid," you know.
It makes me really think about Harold Hill's background.
Yeah.
Like, was he that kid?
Right.
Did he just kind of raise himself and figure out how to make a living and then in the meanwhile kind of gain a sense of empathy for anybody who mm-hmm. who doesn't have someone to believe in them?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I think this is a good moment because since we're talking about Charlie the salesman and, you know, calling out Harold Hill for what he is, which is a con man, mm-hmm. that this, in many ways, not just because of how it sounds and because it takes place in the heart of America, it is a quintessentially American musical. Mm-hmm. Harold Hill, this type of character who, in many ways, is like the epitome of the American dream, right? There is a little bit of the think system in every immigrant mm-hmm. that comes to this country thinking, I don't know how this is going to work, but I'm going to believe that it will. Mm-hmm. And kind of that, the craziness of that is something that we really esteem as American. It's why I think The Music Man feels very patriotic to people. Mm-hmm. I think it's why P.T. Barnum is a controversial character mm-hmm. that we continually write about and, I mean, with The Greatest Showman, celebrate. And I think it also, getting political here, I also think that it is kind of a gateway into having a personality like we have in the White House and the polarity of the country and looking at that, mm-hmm. Looking at President Trump. Because in recently watching The Music Man, I couldn't help but feel like, oh, this is how Trump supporters view progressives, quote unquote. The Charlie Cowles who come in and say, this is a con man. Mm-hmm. This is someone who is only out for himself. Mm-hmm. And then everybody else are, you know, the supporters saying it doesn't really matter because what he represents and gives to me is much more than what you're complaining about.
Right. And even more than that, the whole trouble, him stirring up the town and making them worried about that is exactly what Trump did when he was running with the whole wall, the border wall, and the Mexicans and the rapists and all that. It's very similar.
Really stirring up.
Give them something to rally around and to get behind.
Regardless of if it's true
valid
or not.
Yeah, right.
Valid or not. It makes me wonder, what is the difference between President Trump and Harold Hill?
Hmm.
Like, why are we okay in musical theater with Harold Hill but not President Trump?
Well, besides the obvious that one is a piece of entertainment
sure,
and one
sure.
is real life.
Yeah.
There's also the what's at stake,
mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
a bunch of boys
true.
In their band uniforms or
versus
democracy as we know it, or, or, you know, wars breaking out, you know, mm-hmm. international relationships and allies and all of that. I mean, there's much more at stake here
yeah.
than what's at stake in the musical.
I also think that in terms of the person, Harold Hill paints himself to, surely be a savior of the town, and in many ways, as we said, kind of had to convince them they needed a savior, first of all. But he does take himself off the pedestal.
Mm-hmm.
We get the cathartic moment in the musical of once it's come out that he, you know, is kind of a con, a fake, that he sits down Winthrop. And it's very interesting that specifically it's this little boy, and he says, I will tell you the truth about anything you ask. And what does Winthrop ask? Are you a fake? Yes. And he tells the truth. He says mm-hmm. exactly who he is to this little
yeah.
boy. And I find it interesting that it's to Winthrop, and it's not Marion, and it's not anybody in the town. It's the most innocent, who's gained the most, if you will,
mm-hmm.
from his presence.
Mm-hmm.
And And that moment of truth is, I think, really helpful to us as an audience and to continue finding these characters endearing. Whereas I think maybe collectively we don't get that from our current president.
No sense of self-awareness or own, aware of his own flaws or any of that.
I think that might be, for me, kind of the key to thinking that Harold Hill isn't just a total scumbag.
Mm-hmm.
The cool thing is that I guess Marion has reached the point in herself where she doesn't need the truth. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, what she says to Winthrop is that it doesn't really matter that he gave you guys something to dream about, not just him, but herself and the ladies and the barbershop quartet. And she has seen with her own eyes what he did for the town just by giving them something to dream about, to plan for.
And that big emotional complex, of course, happens, of course, during the ice cream sociable.
Right.
And one of my favorite things about musicals, a chase scene.
Yeah.
I love a good chase scene. Let's rewind just a little bit before that, though, and talk about Till There Was You,
mm-hmm.
which I think is kind of a tricky scene because it includes one of the longest kisses.
But it's orchestrated.
Yeah,
it's underscored.
Exactly. So you just kind of have... I mean, when I did Crazy for You, I felt like that was one of the longest kisses because you've been dancing so hard. And so you don't actually kiss. You just breathe. You just breathe on the other person. Into each other's mouths, like CPR style. And everyone's like, oh, it's so romantic. You're like, it's disgusting. So at least it's not that. But still, it's very, very long. And can easily just become, I think, a prom pose and a pretty song.
Yeah, see, I've never thought of it that way because I think of it as an incredibly passionate song and kiss. Mm-hmm. I mean, this woman has not been kissed in
a really long time.
And in my version, every time I've done it, I've kissed him.
Oh.
He did not kiss me.
Suffrage.
Yeah, well, first he's trying to explain and she puts her fingers on his mouth and she's like, no, you don't understand. My life, you have opened up my life. I never heard the bells. I never saw the birds. You know, you have given me all of this, and it doesn't matter if I never see you again because I will have had this. But before you go, I am going to kiss you and kiss you like I mean it.
That's so beautiful.
I have never felt prom-posy about it.
That's so great. Yeah. I love that. Now, Marion has the entire... I mean, she kind of sings the entire thing mm-hmm. first, right?
Right.
And then does he...
He joins her after the kiss.
Does he sing it by himself a little bit?
After he confesses to Winthrop, and he says, I wish you'd never come to River City.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, no, you don't. Look, mm-hmm. look at all the stuff he gave us. And then I say, no, go, Harold. They're about to get you. And Winthrop says, go. And he says, I can't. And he says, why not? And he says, for the first time, I got my foot caught in the door.
Oh, that's right. And then he sings
the
little reprise.
Just a tiny little reprise, and he doesn't even get to finish it, really. The guys come out and grab him, and he gets taken to the gymnasium.
Because I'm just now thinking that for Marion, she's realizing, right, till there was you. I didn't realize that this is how life could be till you came in. And I think on some level, he's like, I didn't realize I was even capable of doing that for someone until
right.
you just told me.
Right.
So.
And the fact that here's a woman with all the facts and she's not turning him in.
Yeah.
She's not.
Like, talk about self-sabotage, having to confront what you've always feared. And what you fear is maybe somebody loving you for who you are.
Right.
It's really powerful. So they bring him kind of tar and feather style to await trial, if you will, because every musical has a trial of some kind. And the town realizes that they feel a little grateful for everything that he's done.
Yeah, because of Marion's speech.
That's right.
Yeah, because
that's
everybody's right. like saying, I haven't seen my, you know, no one knows where their kids are, and they're out $40 or whatever much mm-hmm. for their band uniforms, and everyone's sort of piling on, and then she shuts them down. And she said, have you forgotten what this town was like before he came here?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And so everyone sort of gets on her bandwagon again until, after she's finished, the mayor says, Well, let's just remember one thing. He promises a band. Where's the band?
Where's the band? Where's the band? And then the band enters.
Yes.
With all of these
ragtag,
adorable little kids in
ill-fitting band suits.
Terrible band suits with their instruments. Mm-hmm. And it's such a fantastic ending to the musical because we have all been to, or at least I have, to many a dance recital, mm-hmm. many a soccer game of my nieces and nephews, where everyone's just, like, yelling on stage or onto the field of what they should be doing. Uh-huh. And it certainly isn't, like, good.
Right. There's no level of expertise
going on. There's very little skill, and yet the kids are having a great time, and the parents
are bursting.
Even happier.
Yeah.
You know? And that's ultimately what happens. They all start playing horribly, mm-hmm. and the town is just so ecstatic to see their little kid even mm-hmm. try mm-hmm. to be passionate about a musical instrument. Did you have any of that when you were little?
Yeah, when I started junior high, the high school band director came around to all the junior highs. We had three in our town back then. And he would say, look, there's a high school band. We're award-winning. It's a great opportunity to learn an instrument. And he went into all the junior highs and recruited, basically, and helped set us up with lessons. And I got a clarinet when I was in the seventh grade and started playing in the junior high orchestra, and then I played in the high school band, and then I even played it into college.
Did you really?
It was part of my college scholarship.
Was clarinet?
Yeah, I was all-state band. I was first chair.
Oh my gosh.
A pretty good clarinetist, although I just decked it out a little while ago, and it was disastrous. It was the ugliest sound you ever heard.
Well, but that kind of goes for most instruments. Inevitably, like woodwinds in particular, sound like dying animals.
Yeah, my dad used to come in and say, who's skinning a cat in here?
Oh, shoot.
Or maybe that was when I was singing. I'm not quite sure.
Oh, that's horrible. Same with, like, violins. I can't imagine.
So bad.
Oof.
Yeah, I had an argument with a guy once. We were doing Seven Brides for Seven Brothers at this dinner theater in Rockville, Maryland. And we were at the end of Seven Brides, we all get married.
Yep.
And we had a small orchestra, and the violinist was just awful. And every day he would play that the wedding march, you know. And it really was like someone skinning a cat. It was just, and one night I had just had it. I came off stage, it was the end of the show, and I was getting undressed. And I was like, it was one of those dressing rooms where the boys were on one side of the mirrors and the girls were on the other side of the mirrors.
Oh, wow. I mean,
non-union musical theater.
Living the dream.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, what is wrong? Why can't the guy play the violin? It's so bad. And the guy who played the minister in the show, I don't remember his name, but he was so upset with me. He was like, the violin is a very difficult instrument. And I said, not for a violinist. It's not. Yeah, it's bad.
Oh, my gosh. But I'm sure people in the pit have thought the same about me when I started singing.
Like, it's a matinee.
It's a matinee, isn't it, Jeff? Sure is. And that's Music Man.
That's Music Man.
Oh, my gosh. It's a sweet, wonderful, entertaining, incredibly entertaining, and very intelligently put together show. And I really, really love it. Where do you think it ranks in terms of theater history? Do you think that it'll keep going?
I do. I think it's beloved. There are people that, I know people my age and younger that revere it, mm-hmm. you know, that can quote it, mm-hmm. you know, that will go see it and anticipate where they're going to cry, you know, just stuff like that.
I remember church leaders, high up church leaders, quoting the Tomorrow's Line. What is it?
Let's see. Maybe tomorrow. My dear Miss Marion, pile up enough tomorrows and you'll find that all you have is a lot of empty yesterdays.
Oof. That's a great line.
Yeah.
Yeah, that made it into, like, the canon.
Oh, wow.
Of like, LDS speak from the pulpit.
Yeah.
So it's definitely loved where I'm from. I hope that it will continue to be done. The fact remains is that it's about a time when the culture of women was like, you just get married. So that's like a huge part of the plot. And I sometimes wonder if shows like this or My Fair Lady, like, audiences just won't care to see those kinds of stories about women anymore?
Yeah, I mean, there are things that are becoming... we're becoming more aware of being problematic in that regard, like even Carousel with the abuse.
Sure.
And My Fair Lady, like, with the slippers at the end.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I can get that. I think Music Man less so, because by the end, they're really meeting
as partners.
Equals.
You're right.
He's given up a fair amount to make the decision to stay.
That's a really good point to bring up, is that we feel that by the end,
she has tamed him as much as he has opened her eyes.
Yeah, that he's not going to continue.
Mm-mm. He's setting the shot next to Marcellus, and he's going to actually lead the band.
And Marion is a great partner to have because
she actually
knows about music.
Right.
He has the dream and she has the know-how, and they'd make a great team. And a house. He doesn't even need to buy a house. He can move Widow Peru into Winthrop's room, or maybe in the closet under the staircase.
That's right.
So when the show opened, Barbara Cook has this amazing story about what Meredith Willson gave her for opening that gift, and I wanted to read it from her book. She says, "On opening night, he gave me the most beautiful present, a heart from Tiffany. When you opened the heart, you had two hearts, and when you opened that further, it became a four-leaf clover.
Oh my gosh.
On the inside of each of those four hearts, he had engraved the beginning bars of all four of my big songs in the show. Then when you closed the heart up, on one side it said Barbara, and on the other it said Marion."
Wow.
It was so thoughtful, the nicest opening night gift I've ever received.
I guess.
Isn't that sweet?
Yeah.
And everything that I've read about him says that he was a very warm, congenial, nice guy to work with, which I think is, especially for someone who seems to be really interested in is working by himself, or at least, like, taking credit for his work, is kind of impressive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We already talked about the fact that it came out the same time as West Side Story, but at the Tony Awards that year, it won Best Musical. Barbara Cook won Best Featured Actress, which is strange.
That is strange.
I think it was a thing about Robert Preston's name was above the title, so he was leading actor, but then she was, like, down a ways, so then she became... Anyway, it's those weird rules. Oh my gosh, I think I was totally wrong. It was actually 1958. Here I've been saying 1957.
Oh, yeah, 58
it was 1958.
Was Music Man.
Yeah, 1958 was Music Man. So then, sorry, I pulled out my book here. So the Best Musical nominees in 1958 were West Side Story, New Girl in Town, The Music Man, O Captain, which was a total flop, and just has, like, a nudie girl on the... Like, I think it was a return to, like, businessman nudie musicals, which was weird. And then Jamaica. And The Music Man was the thing that won pretty much everything. So,
interesting
year.
How many years later was the film of West Side Story?
Ooh, good question. Let me look.
And I'm wondering if it was made a film before Music Man was.
I think Music Man was first. Okay, Music Man, the film, was 1962. West Side was 61.
So West Side was first.
Wow, I didn't realize that. Maybe because Music Man was a big enough hit on Broadway and touring, etc., that they felt like they didn't need to make a musical version? I don't know.
A film, you mean? Yeah.
Oh, you see, yeah, sorry, a film version.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Does Barbara talk about not getting the movie?
She left Music Man because she got pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And so she was just interested in...
Being
the mom, raising the family.
And, you know, Shirley was pregnant during the footbridge scene.
Yes. Well, it's really funny to see her, because they took such a long time to make those movies, those, you know, big musicals at
that
point.
They tried to hide it as best they could, but you can totally see it.
Yeah, especially during that footbridge scene. They've, like, squeezed her in. That isn't the famous story that she was hugging Robert Preston?
Yeah.
And
it was the embrace. It was the big one. She felt, he felt...
And
she hadn't told anybody.
Because Maureen DaCosta had said, all right, she had told him, the director.
Right.
And he was like, okay, but just don't tell anybody else.
Right.
And then Robert Preston feels the kick and was like, what? What was that? And then she says, that was Patrick Cassidy.
Yeah, she told that story in our little tour that we did.
It's a great story.
Yeah.
Terry Bibb, well, let's see what... Yeah, it's time. Thank you so much
Thank
for
you.
Having a conversation with me. As always, if you have an idea for a show that you'd like us to cover on a musical theater podcast, you can always email us at amusicalpodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Twitter at amusicalpodcast. Thank you, Meredith Wilson. Thank you, Anna White, Barbara Cook, Robert Preston, for giving us some great material to talk about. And Terry, I worship you.
Aw, you're the sweetest. Thanks, Jeff.
Bye, buddy.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.